Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Pulley.
And I am Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for September 15th, 2025. Tom, what do you got for us this week?
All right, we're going to kick it off this week with an article from, and I really hope I pronounce this right, but this is what I'm going to roll with. So, Scott, if you need to correct me, but it's from Jamf Threat Labs. That's J-A-M-F. It's titled Chilly Hell, a deep dive into a modular macOS backdoor. So, Jamf Threat Labs identified through a sample analysis on VirusTotal a specific file that carried a notable method of process reconnaissance. And this tied to a known malware family that has been documented in the past, but this new file remained unflagged within VirusTotal. The sample is developer signed and successfully passed Apple's notarization process way back in 2021. It has remained active until the findings were reported by Jamf Threat Labs, which is I found interesting. So Mandiant's private 2023 report linked UNC4487 to a 2022 compromise of the Ukrainian government. The government used auto insurance website that delivered Matenbukis malware. Attackers sold access to infected systems while investigating that malware's signing certificate. And Mandiant also uncovered additional samples they named Chilly Hell, but there were no real technical details for Chilly Hell at that time. Or sense. So some of the technical details behind what has been found now, the executable applet is a modular C++ backdoor that's developed for Intel architectures and packaged as an applet.app, but it does not function as a legitimate macOS applet. And on execution, it begins host profiling, and then it works to establish its persistence. If it succeeds, it will make its move to establish their C2 comms before moving into its primary command loop. For host profiling, we see a function that queries the local directory service to enumerate all the user accounts. The command used for this is dscl-plist.readall, and it focuses at the user's directory, specifically looking for that record name, unique ID, user shell, and the NFS home directory pieces. This returns detailed information about all of those user records on the system in a plist format, which typically outputs, if it's not directly saved somewhere, typically outputs in like an XML JSON formatting, which can be pretty highly leveraged for automation script usage, et cetera. It's also seen as an attempt to gather all active PIDs through the use of the PSAX command. And then it'll identify who the active user is leveraging who am I before establishing the environment object that is initialized with default value, setting that username to root. So when we move into the persistence side, if through that host profiling, the active user is a regular user, Chilly Hell will install itself as a launch agent, writing a plist file to the /library/launch agents directory. And then its binary will be one level up under that /library directory. If it has user elevated privileges, however, it's going to establish that main binary under the /user/local/bin/qtop. So Chilly Hell can also modify the user's shell profile to ensure that malware is executed on each new terminal session. So when run manually, Chilly Hell will daemonize itself using that OS fork daemon call, which uses the traditional double fork to create a new session and detach from its parent, redirecting that standard input output to /dev/null. It also opens a decoy URL to google.com in the default browser, likely to reduce user suspicion, but I think also as part of the following command process to verify internet connections. So Chilly Hell will also perform a time stomp on the artifacts it creates with the target environment, leveraging the touch command, specifically with the flags for -c, -a, and -m. And then after next step, kind of moving into that C2 side, Chilly Hell will do a test reach out to the Google DNS server at 8.8.8.8 to confirm that internet connection exists. And then once it's established, that'll hard code its C2 IPs. But some of the notable things that will then occur when the main execution loop begins. So it will retrieve tasks from the C2, and then it deduplicates those tasks from the retrieve list to kind of look what's actually already running on the machine to kind of keep itself up to date. It executes tasks that are new by passing a base64 encoded strings to be decoded and parsed for content parameters. Some of the task modules will also send status reports back to that C2, as well as other tracking items like process IDs, payload memories, things like that. The primary tasks called are module back connect shell, which basically just connects to that C2 and manages that connection. Module updater, which downloads newer versions of the malware from the C2. The module loader, which downloads a new payload and executes it. And then the final one, the module subf, which basically enumerates user accounts, performs password cracking, typically looking and leveraging that /etc/passwd file. It will then download a brute force tool and a password list to aid in kind of cracking those passwords. And then it will attempt to use those credentials, leveraging another payload specified as ./Kerberos. It's a binary that's pulled down from the C2 as part of the payload pull-down processes. And then all of the successes are written to a file called good.txt and then additionally uploaded to that C2. So taking a bit of a breath, Scott, because I thought that was a lot to kind of walk through. But one of the interesting, I thought this one was interesting, mainly because we don't really talk a lot about macOS. So this took me down some rabbit holes of looking more into this side of the house. It's not something that I specifically do a whole lot of hands-on with. I have some knowledge of it, but I always, every time I look at macOS stuff, I start seeing new things. This one, I actually found my way down a handful of rabbit hole about the functionality of that plist. But I also thought it was cool seeing the collaboration between Jamf Threat Labs and Google Threat Intelligence to kind of break down and compare that old and new findings. It seemed like there was real clean collaboration that was referenced in this report that kind of helped kind of bring this consensus to life. But yeah, you know, what did you think of this one, Scott?
Yeah, the Mac stuff's really interesting. The one thing that I think's more interesting to me about this one is it seems to behave slightly different than some of the other like Mac info stealer type stuff that we've seen a lot of or a lot more of lately. There are a few things that I thought were notable as far as like how it behaves on the system. Some of the things you called out, that's a couple notable things was the use of the directory service listing, I think is what the name of that, the DSCL, right? I haven't seen that before when looking at specific Mac related things. And so I didn't know that was a use for discovery. So that's like an interesting discovery technique to kind of take away from this. And it's also unique enough because I don't think it's as common talked about, so it could help you almost kind of fingerprint some behavior. Obviously the PS it usually use aux as the command when you see it from like a forensics or, you know, admin perspective, but PS space AX, which is basically looking at like what are the user IDs, process IDs and command line arguments for every single process. It's a great way to kind of enumerate things on the system as far as what's running. Some of the persistent mechanisms. You mentioned the forking. I was trying to kind of wrap my head around what that would look like from a behavior perspective. And what I would expect is you basically would have it be a parent of itself. And then the parent exits. So, you know, there are certain logging depending on what kind of visibility you have, but that might be something you might be able to leverage that, like, I guess, combination of behaviors to say, hey, this kind of looks like that forking behavior to isolate itself. Or, you know, they refer to it as daemonizing itself. So that might be something interesting to look at. Unfortunately, I feel like that is an uncommon for some things. So you probably have to like be familiar with your environment and knowing what kind of tools and processes you are typically running to pay attention to. The time stomping thing was also interesting. Just because they do try to adjust and manipulate the timestamps, and I'm not really sure what they're trying to benefit from this, like why this is so important, but they do try to utilize a function call, and if that doesn't work, they actually use touch And touch is kind of interesting too, because there's so many different things adversaries have used for touch other than, and ways they try to manipulate timestamps with it. So it's something worth paying attention to, from like the stealthy aspect of that. And then, the last thing I thought was just kind of a good note was, and you talked about how they can pass encoded commands, with their C2, and their C2 infrastructure kind of consists of, DNS as well as HTTP or HTTPS. And the one thing that I always find beneficial is if you kind of set up and control your environment, you can kind of create the norms, for instance. And I know like a lot of this, you know, work remote and all that kind of stuff, split tunneling and things, sometimes you don't have that same kind of luxury, but it's always good if you can kind of control your own DNS for all your infrastructure. One, because it gives you really good visibility as far as like a data point, like where, what are things going, what are things querying about, that kind of stuff. It's a great way to indicate for that. But also, if you have any kind of ways to capture where DNS is going somewhere other than what you specified, because adversaries do a lot of times, either for testing connectivity as an example, or, you know, just how they do it, they hard code DNS addresses, which, you know, in turn aren't malicious, but it would be an easy way to kind of pick up on, hey, well, that's abnormal because our policies and configurations point here. And now something's trying to talk, either you're able to block it because you kind of, you know, where that host is contained within some sort of enclave you control, or you're able to at least know what's going on to know, hey, there's something specific doing separate calls that's unique to the rest of everything else on the system that it's configured for natively. So that's something to kind of, I think, when you have those discussions and things to pay attention to, DNS is a great resource for that. And how you implement architect that, especially with the different type of working environments, can pose some challenges, but it's not something to think about, especially if you already have it in place. So there's the big ones, but it was a very interesting capabilities and things kind of all stacked together that I liked. Oh, another thing was depending on what kind of telemetry you have, or if you have an EDR that's running, file accesses, anything that's kind of touching. I think that they even mentioned they try to enumerate users from the shadow file, Etsy shadow. Sometimes you can, from telemetry, see what processes are touching specific things, and paying attention to that is a good indication of why is this trying to interact with or read a specific file in the system. So yeah, that was the big catches for me, I think.
Yeah, good points. This actually motivated me because I hate like having some lack of knowledge in certain areas. You know, like you always want to fill that cup. So the left side has been, it's been fun. It's been fun to hit a few rabbit holes on this. What do you got next for us, Scott?
Yeah. So the next one, you pull up the article so I can read the title exactly. So this is from Secure List. And it basically, it's titled Shiny Tools, Shallow Checks, How the AI Hype Opens the Door to Malicious MCP servers. So this was interesting to me because honestly, I've never heard of an MCP server. I wasn't really sure what one was, but the idea of an MCP server is it enables you to kind of use natural language to integrate with other services and to perform other things. So like, what does that mean? It's almost like, you know, how we used to write integrations for APIs to be able to interact with systems, extract data, maybe call and do certain functions or do whatever. Well, with this type of setup, you're able to say, hey, with your natural language, I want to do X. Then it gets passed to the MCP server, and all the functions and calls that it's kind of set up with, it can interpret whatever you're asking as the normal language and then process it with how it knows how to interact with those services to do whatever actions on your behalf to execute what it can, and then return whatever results or, you know, whatever that looks like. So kind of a good, I guess, example that I'll kind of play out of what that could look like is, you know, maybe, scenario where we created an MCP server. This is called, GitHub MCP, and it exposes three different tools listed in it, which is basically list pull requests. So you can see requests that are there, create issues within GitHub, and then get user information, for instance. All that sound very API, right? Integration stuff. But you can basically say, hey, show me all the open PRs and whatever API repo. And it will go, and the LM and the client side will parse that and then decide which tool to call. And then it sends that to the server. The server then will will basically map it to the different function things, construct the call to GitHub, pull all that information back. And now it will read it back to you and also a normal language return as well, kind of like interacting almost with how you would do ChatGPT or some other LLMs, but it's actually able to interact and do things. So it's almost like the automation component. So really interesting and can be really valuable. But what the article was trying to basically highlight was all the different attack vectors that could potentially be there, right? You got kind of protocol level abuses where basically same thing. People will build MCP servers, right? Share them in Docker, share the code base so that you can stand one up real easily. So you kind of run into that supply chain issue with some of that. But then there's also, it could be spoofing or poisoning that can happen. Or sometimes you can have like a distribution of them. So you can kind of have shadowing, overriding definitions and a multi-server setup. So you can like be part of a pool of MCP servers that can have negative consequences. And then also you can stand something up, like a malicious person can stand something up that's usable up front, and then the code gets replaced on the back end, and you're already subscribed to these MCP servers. And then now other things are happening that are not beneficial. So I just thought it was really interesting to kind of basically understand what an MCP server is, and then also try to think back to new technologies. That means new risks, new attack vectors potentially. Even like I was curious, because MCP server is kind of interpreting your requests. Could you even trick an MCP server to do things that it may be shouldn't be doing, kind of thing? And then also the other context is if you're interacting with an MCP server and you're setting this stuff up, the client that's doing the request is asking those requests with the same user privileges that you have. So then you have that kind of restriction or that kind of risk associated with that as well, right? Because maybe if you have a developer who has a lot of access is using this, well, now their developer type access is being kind of shared in a way, right? Depending on what the client comes back and tries to do as well. So there was some of the research they did to actually try to set up a malicious MCP server. And they talk about it in this article and how they can get it to basically enumerate certain things within your environments with the client by pulling in all the different SSH keys, API tokens, that kind of stuff. So it was just kind of a way to highlight how MCP servers could be used maliciously. They create some scenarios, and granted, some of this is still hypothesis, hypothetical. Some of this, I think, it could potentially exist. But I think it's good for people to be aware of, especially they spell it out in the title, AI hype. If there's ways where you can integrate with things faster and get things done easier, people are going to gravitate towards this. And I think this is a really cool solution. And then one of the things I think is really cool about the MCP servers is you can set it up where it has the different functionalities that it can try to map your requests to, but it also can have example prompts for things you may want to do to help basically control what your outputs or inputs would look like to make it even more streamlined and potentially even better results as well. Something that I'm kind of curious to explore, because I can see a lot of use cases personally where I would like something like this. But now understanding, how attackers could be looking at the same thing, especially with potentially going after people that are, kind of default nature is to trust something that this works for you, right? So yeah, I don't know how much you've ever dug into MCP servers because this is the first time I've seen it, but I found this fascinating. I'm just curious, you know, what are your thoughts or questions on this?
Yeah, so not very much. I've heard it referenced before and had like a very generic understanding of it, but a couple things that I thought that I think are interesting in the capabilities of the kind of attack landscape with MCPs was a little eye-opening to me. So it's not necessarily something that is net new, overwhelmingly novel in any way, but just the volume of what can be accomplished with this. One of the ones that stood out specifically where the article talked about was that MCP naming confusion. I thought it was interesting when, you know, basically it says an attacker could register a malicious MCP server with a name almost identical to a legitimate one. So when an AI assistant performs name-based discovery, it resolves to that rogue server and then kind of hands over those tokens or the sensitive queries. That seems almost too easy. I was a little like, oh, wait, I want to look at that more. How is that so easy? But I guess the way that they're trying to create this MCP server has this one-stop shop for many things, ease of use kind of approach. I could see how that could be a void, which sort of sucks for, you know, people that are looking to spin this stuff up. Also a little scary. So if you kind of walk down the idea of the different paths between like poisoning, they talk about rug pull scenarios, but one of the ones that had me interested is where it kind of goes into that, where you could see the potential supply chain abuse in this, using that kind of fashion. We already see, and we've talked about a lot of the stuff that gets leveraged on the, like the supply chain, and I'm throwing some air quotes on there because it depends on how you reference it. But like that recent NPM fiasco, right?
Developers are like, and we feel like a bigger attack service nowadays.
Yeah.
And the requirement for speed to market, the light speed pace that people are trying to adopt, develop, and sell AI functionalities, tools, etc. That's the part that I think was the most eye opening here of, you know, kind of keeping an eye on this one and watching this one. So something I want to get hip to. I want to understand this flow a little better too. I'd love to get into a lab and see how this functions, you know?
Yeah. Like two places my brain goes to, one, even from a developer standpoint, if you were designing an MCP server, you know, kind of the same risk you run with the APIs. If you open up too much, you're kind of expose yourself to potentially some risk. Right. But, as a designer developer, you want to offer a lot of capabilities, but if, for instance, you're not thinking about how those capabilities could be leveraged together, you might be kind of like how you see, hey, there's three low vulnerabilities and that led to like a bad thing because now you have like three different functions that you opened up that now when they're all leveraged together, because MCP server can kind of say, oh, this person wants to do this. I've got these three or four different things I could do, put all that together. And now maybe something unintended occurs. So I thought about that, but then I also thought, like, from a great capability perspective, you know, we've always talked about how we've leveraged automation for enrichment and contextualization in like a SOC operational environment, right? And that's like a huge win. But imagine if you had something a little kind of more intelligent that basically take either based on predefined prompts or things to help enable getting at the right information that's the most relevant than just a lot of information. That sometimes automation, I think that's what you run into sometimes, right? Like, hey, give me everything known on this IP because this popped up. That might not be as helpful, right? So I feel like there's a lot of capability here to bolster, you know, if there's some pre-built MCP specifically for SOC operational purposes that can tie to things, I think that would be really cool.
You know, I think there's also relatively obvious, well, maybe not obvious. You can please poke holes in my thinking process here, Scott. But when we look at this stuff and we always talk about that adaptation, I know in the past we've talked about kind of those partnerships between the different, you know, between the developer and the security side and like, you know, making sure that your environment is protected, but can also kind of run to that speed of market pace. I was brainstorming in my own head, just thinking about things like, and you talked about like, what if a SOC was trying to leverage something like this to help with automation? Like, wouldn't a potential good way when you're looking at adopting these things in consideration of what this article is talking about to really kind of like pair, hey, I'm going to launch these things. Maybe there's things that are net new. Maybe, you know, some of these repositories or some of these, some of the libraries or things being used for this aren't, don't have a necessarily a streamlined path to being overly evaluated. Wouldn't a good way be to kind of look at some of the things that could be accomplished with this from a security side? So what I'm getting at is, if you're going to spin this up, or if your development team is going to spin this up, couldn't you, you know, wouldn't it be a good idea to kind of really pair in like the security posture side of, hey, we're spinning up these net new models. Let's consider this thing and maybe monitor, put a little more scrutiny on monitoring things like, you know, network traffic with unexpected posts, or, you know, additional, you know, posts with Base64 encoding, you know, just, I don't know if I'm saying this clearly, but really kind of like marrying those two things organically to say, hey, we're trying to do this new thing. We're trying to leverage this new AI server. How can we also leverage security to make sure that we don't have any gaps that we're not considering? Maybe we've checked the code. Maybe the code didn't necessarily show anything because it's more novel. And, but then you have this, the switch flip, like they talked about in the article, where it appears to be legitimate. Once you get the API connected, the backend switches and now it's doing malicious things. So, you know, the front end code check may not be enough. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah. And that's why I think it'd be cool if you kind of owned your own MCP instance that you leveraged, because I think you can control the code base. Even if someone else, for instance, like develops the code, as long as you're not like updating it live and you're controlling those things, you can do reviews when you do updates, you know, I think you can do some of the code managed that way. But if you also control your own instance of an MCP, then versus like just subscribing to someone else's that's kind of stood up for you, you also have also a better visibility, because if you develop it yourself, I've also read, looking at some things, that some of them just have really good logging capabilities natively anyways when they're built out. So you can kind of see what data is going in and out, what requests are being made, all that kind of stuff, which may be actually more beneficial data than potentially like an actual application logs, where there's just a lot of noise in application logs, right? Because now you're caring about interaction, not just what the app is doing. So there may be like a lot of potentials there. It just depends on how, you know, things are architected and how things are utilized, right? But I think the technology is really cool. I think people should be aware of it, especially with how AI just kind of falls in people's laps. And it's better to at least be thinking about solutions and problems ahead of this before, you know, you're just kind of forced to deal with it. And then you feel like you're behind, or you don't have any input, so you can't even, you know, steer the train.
Yeah, very much so.
All right. Well, what do you got for us next?
All right. Next one I have is from Bitdefender. It's titled Eggstream Malware, Unpacking a New APT Framework That's Targeting a Philippine Military Company. So a Chinese APT compromised a Philippine military contractor with a new fileless framework called Eggstream. The multi-stage toolkit maintains stealthy, persistent access by loading malicious code into memory and abusing DLL sideloading to run its payloads. Its main component, the Eggstream agent, is a pretty powerful backdoor that performs deep reconnaissance, enables lateral movement, and captures sensitive data via an injected keylogger. So I'm going to kind of hit a lot of bullets on this. This article was pretty lengthy. I'm definitely going to leave some holes for you to jump in there, Scott. But let's just kind of start with the attack and infection chain. So basically, the initial compromise is via a logon batch script that's placed on an SMB share. The method, though, this was something that I thought was interesting in the article. The method of how it was placed is kind of still under investigation. They're not entirely certain of that piece yet. But the script drops a couple things. So it drops a winmail.exe, which is a legitimate binary, and then an additional DLL with it to kind of perform DLL sideloading around that Microsoft Windows Mail piece. And then the components that kind of get dropped in with their in the execution flow that follows. So there is the Eggstream Fuel, which is the first stage loader via the DLL. It sets up a reverse shell and does some system fingerprinting. And then the Eggstream Loader, which is a setup as like a Windows service, it decrypts the secondary payloads, which are the reflective loader and the agent, that are bundled inside of a file of a .exe.mui file. And then the extreme reflective loader. So this is kind of the meat and potatoes of it. It injects the final backdoor into a trusted process. So it takes that winlogon.exe and kind of captures that, elevates privileges by configuring its established service to run with that SE debug privilege. So it kind of captures that. The core backdoor, so that extreme agent, it operates fileless, as I had mentioned, so decrypts payloads, run in memory, minimal disk traces, etc. It supports around 58 commands for a lot of things. So we're talking reconnaissance, lateral movement, data theft, file operations, privilege esc, and more. I thought some of the more interesting ones to call out of that whole list of capabilities was the ability to do screenshotting. Again, we're seeing time stomping of files, the read, write, and delete of files, the specific lists and targets at drivers and registry keys, and then enumerating services. And there's just a lot there, so much more there. It uses the gRPC with mutual TLS for C2 communication, and it includes that keylogger that was mentioned a minute ago, the keylogger module, which decrypts the keylogger into explorer.exe, and then it'll monitor your keystrokes, your clipboard, active windows, etc. So some of the persistent pieces, it will abuse the legitimate Windows services that were mentioned before to kind of hide from detection, uses service binary replacement or registry changes to load that malicious DLL. It does employ encryption with the XOR RC4 encrypted payloads, in-memory injection, and then the reflective loading to avoid touching disk. There is a couple of bullet points I hit here for the infrastructure side. So it does use a CA with a specific subject key identifier. All the C2 servers use certificates issued by it. And then it does have multiple C2 domains that it goes after. And the infrastructure seems to be constantly being refreshed. I did go do this one a little bit fast, Scott. There was a lot there. I was trying to really just kind of encompass a really big overview because this article is pretty deep. We can see through that heavy use of the living off the land approaches, the highly developed capabilities, and that advanced understanding of newer techniques, making this at minimum worthwhile to understand a bit more. It's always interesting when you kind of target nation state style stuff or nation state seemingly backed things. Mm-hmm. But with that said, what were some of your takeaways?
Yeah, so I think that was one of the biggest ones was, you know, some of the questions that, especially nowadays, when I see attacks, is I try to associate, is this more criminal or just more nation driven, right? And the reason why I do that is because I feel like if something is criminal, behaviors and things I find, I can expect them to kind of be shared or seen across groups a lot of times. And for some of the nation driven stuff, I know that eventually people adopt some of the capabilities, especially as stuff gets reported, but I also kind of learned newer things from them. And so I would definitely put that in the bucket. I mean, I know they call it a new APT, right? Advanced Persistent Threat. But based on the targeting, right? Philippine military company, already it's a target that's really, you know, enticing for a lot of nations. But then you look at the complexity of how they built everything, where they kind of had a bunch of pieces built in parts for one, right? Offering 58 different commands as well. So after you kind of get everything all set up and hooked, then you have all this capability attached with that. I think that's also a very interesting thing. It's like a fully developed, kind of planned out type of attack. And they were able to use already vulnerable Windows binaries for the DLL side loading. So that means, you know, they're paying attention to those types of things or finding those types of things. One of the things I thought was interesting was that it says the most critical function is establish a reverse shell, right? Obviously that communication, and it does by invoking, you know, CMD.exe. It doesn't really basically call on like what is run with CMD, it just that it invokes it. So I thought that was interesting. And from what it looks like it also hollows out, or not hollow out, but it injects itself into explorer.exe. So even if you saw Explorer launch CMD, it wouldn't be suspicious from an execution standpoint. But also, another note is the attacker abused several disabled Windows services. So the fact that it says attacker abused several disabled Windows services, what's interesting here is the article is about them attacking one target, right? From my guess, based on those titled, right? And if the mode of operation isn't like a rinse and repeat style where they always use this for this one campaign, they always, like, they are going out of their way to not necessarily repeat a lot of pieces so that they don't tip anything off. So if something weird happened, it's not going to be associated with something else in the network. Like, you kind of are able to maintain yourself even if being discovered, or make it harder to be discovered in general because of that. I thought that was a strategic move that isn't common with a lot of criminal behaviors, because, you know, if you're looking at what Windows services aren't being run and then trying to take those over, and they're not always the same service, I think that's interesting. Like I said, they injected either into MSMP engine, which is the Defender piece, or Explorer.exe. Only thing usually I try to pay attention to, which I don't know if I saw any of the technical specific stuff here, was what do those processes do? Either if you have the network telemetry, because usually there isn't network telemetry for some of those, and also what other executions are they responsible for any kind of chaining to things that are not standard. Explorer is a lot harder to, you know, drive from, because that's kind of how everyone drives the system. They did kind of walk through the persistence piece, but they said it's a conceptual sequence of commands. So my guess is they know kind of what happened, but they assume this is how it was done. So they, I'm assuming they assume that they wasn't like driven via APIs, but they did, you know, a take own where they're basically getting themselves permissions to specific system 32 files. They're changing the file permissions with ICACLS. They're setting up the service. They're renaming specific things. All this looks like it's done from the command line using some of those, I think, are built in executables. So you can see that behavior in that sequence, and some of them maybe, I don't know if rename is an executable or if it's just built into like CMD. I'd have to look that up personally. But then they also create like a firewall rule to allow inbound connections to explore.exe, which I thought was interesting, because that's really abnormal, I would say. So the only other thing that you mentioned, which I thought was really interesting, was the reuse of their CA to kind of set up a lot of their infrastructure, because they went out of their way to, you know, change actions on the environment. Maybe they thought this piece might be kind of overlooked, or maybe too much of a hassle, or maybe there is other infrastructure associated to another CA, potentially. I don't know answer that, but I think it's a great example of, hey, if you're dealing with something like this, or you're curious, like, what's the level of this attack and what other things should we be looking for? Sometimes cryptographic keys or cert keys are overlooked, but they're leveraged in a lot of ways, just because that's kind of how a lot of services and things work on the internet nowadays. So paying attention to those and finding ways in which you can leverage those, especially if you have access to data where you can look for or look up things based on that, can be hugely valuable. And I think this is a good example of that here, which I don't think, is commonly talked about. But yeah, those were, I would say, some of the key things that really stood out to me that are worth paying attention to. Obviously, there's just some fascinating things, because it's a great technical write-up, and they kind of walk through a lot of the different capabilities of the actual malware and what it can do. It can pretty much do everything you would think you would want to be able to do and you would expect from a well-developed framework. I mean, people, if they're familiar with Cobalt Strike, their Brute Retell, and some other things, I think you won't be surprised at some of the capabilities listed even here for this. But it being a framework also means, if they're especially calling it a framework, also means that there's going to probably be iterations of something like this Or maybe potential different adoptions if it's something that isn't just 100% proprietary. So I think it's worth paying attention to from that perspective as well. But yeah, so.
Yeah, definitely pretty sophisticated and highly, it looks like it's meant to be highly adaptable to the given target or the given use, right? So yeah, I expect to see this, maybe not necessarily named the same, but some definitely see this again.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, last one up for this week. What you got?
Yeah, so this one is article on We Live Security, and it's reported by ESET. And it is called Introducing Hybrid Petya/Not Petya Copycat with UEFI Secure Boot Bypass. So notable things. What is Hybrid Petya, right? It's a new ransomware sample discovered by ESET back in February. And it resembles Petya, Not Petya, but with the added ability to actually infect the UEFI-based system via bootkit. And they can bypass on some systems the secure boot using a vulnerability that I'll mention what that is specifically. But the main capabilities of this ransomware, it encrypts the master file table, the NFT, on NTFS partition. So what's one of the key things about NTFS? It's the main Windows file system. Set up and how it operates, right? When you save things to an NTFS partition or drive, all your files aren't written sequentially. I mean, I think a lot of people that have at least been around long enough know that it's just your file is broken up into pieces and sprayed across because, you know, for instance, sectors on a specific hard drive, like the little blocks that it uses to build things, are a specific size. And so it has to break it up. Naturally, but it also doesn't write it linearly. It just kind of scatters it, and that's supposed to help with read and write times, I believe. Maybe more with write than it is with read, to be honest, because I know if you defrag and actually line up your files sequentially, I think read becomes better. But NFT is the file table that is able to record how those files are all stitched together. So it's basically like the map that the operating system can use to say, hey, you're looking for this file, go grab these pieces. So it's an interesting way to disable a drive. It's just encrypting that really simple table. And now pretty much it renders all the data on that drive useless. I'm sure if you had the right kind of forensic tools that can look for like file headers, you might be able to recover some data. But like I said, if the file is broken up, then you might run into problems getting all of the file unless you have like a perfectly defragged drive that you might be able to just carve out those pieces. But the vulnerability they're talking about where you can bypass secure boot has been patched. Basically, it allows an unsolder modified components to run even if that secure boot option is enabled because it uses a signed but vulnerable UEFI application that was discovered called reloader.efi. And basically, it's vulnerable to loading code that maybe isn't signed and protected by secure boot. So the application gets loaded while secure boot does the check. And then the application is then able to load something else, kind of bypassing that whole process because the other piece wasn't validated. So that's kind of how that vulnerability works. But basically when the ransomware gets installed, it's installed, it tries to detect if the system is UEFI and also GPT. And then it looks for the ESP partition, which is where the UEFI, all the files and things associated with, UEFI is located. It's in the EFI partition. And then, you know, usually you see the path that EFI, Microsoft boot, and that's where you usually you'll see the boot ngfw.efi. That is like, hey, this is how you boot to Windows. Well, it will back that up, make that the same name, but then add the extension .old. And then it removes the fallback bootloaders as well. And then that also will force a reboot after it does this when it inputs these other files in place as well, to basically force a blue screen so that you're forced to reboot, and then now things won't come up properly because it doesn't have the right boot MGFW file. And then the boot kit runs, and it has multiple flags for if is it ready, is it encrypted, is does it need to be decrypted. It uses SALSA 20 key and a nonce to basically build an encryption. It drops a file that is purely like a verify file, so that when you're given the right encryption key, it will try it against that verify file. And if it works, then it knows it's the right key, and then it can decrypt everything else. That is the one thing that is uniquely different, is this ransomware compared to like the Petya, not Petya stuff, is you can decrypt. Some of the Petya, not Petya, you run into where it really was just destructive. There was no retention of a key or no capabilities to really decrypt it in that case. In the variant where it had the secure boot bypass, it also used a cloak.dat file that was what was actually loaded by the reloader, .efi, which is that vulnerable signed piece that has since been patched in January. That was one of the things that it used for that component. But yeah, so, I mean, it's a huge escalation. If you're able to tamper or get things changed in the UEFI, you have a lot of capability on the system, because it's kind of before a lot of things security-wise are preloaded. The master file table, there is like a secondary type MFT table, but it's not full, and it's supposed to kind of help with like potential corruption or partial issues with MFT table, but it's not enough to recover everything. So it really is hard to recover from that. And then, yeah. So I think the biggest challenge, and what's so scary about this now, is some of the reporting is they haven't seen this in the wild. So they haven't really been able to see this being delivered or leveraged, right? They've just seen some, I don't know if it was a researcher or someone posing as like, here's a new capability they have from an attacker perspective. But they're able to find files that are being tested. They're able to then extract and look at and know that they're leveraging these types of techniques. And that's what the intention of this is. So it's kind of like a pre-find, so to speak, right? Before this is like actually leveraged in mass. But that's the problem, is even some of the things we talked about today, if you're able to see writes to the EFI folder, all that kind of stuff, that's kind of happening too late in the attack chain, where a lot of the damage has probably already been done and it's really hard to recover from. So I think, not saying hopefully, but hopefully if someone gets hit by this, there's good reporting on what was the attack vector, what were the steps that had to happen before to get this to execute, and so forth in an environment, especially because, you know, a lot of times you have to get the, is it the right target discovery that usually occurs. There might be, how to get around certain tools, security tools or ERs. So there might be some of the defense evasion stuff going on that's detectable. Like there'll be a lot of things in that chain that lead up to this. This is identifiable. But unfortunately, this article kind of just tells you that this is a real problem. And they don't really have much other than how it works and what the overall impact would be. So like I said, it's a really interesting approach. I'm always fascinated when there's ransomware that finds easier ways to disable a system and not actually have to go through the terrible process of encrypting every single file, because theoretically that can be very time consuming, especially on really, really, really big data stores. I think that's why I was even fascinated when there was, I forgot what ransomware was now, where they just like encrypted the first like so many bytes of a file, so they didn't have to go through the whole thing, which would be enough potentially to kind of just ruin the file. Just for speed's sake, right? So yeah, it's something that I thought was interesting, worth noting. I know people are talking about it, but as of now, I don't think there's a great way as far as detecting this other than just being aware of it, and look for those traditional signs of profiling, defense evasion, escalation, and then some ways for execution that occur. So yeah, what were your thoughts when you read this?
So you know, one of the points, and I'm gonna kind of throw a question your way, because it's just a thought I had. It's more kind of whiteboarding a bit, but they do talk about how this hybrid Petya is kind of like, they say it's at least the fourth publicly known example of a real or proof of concept UEFI boot kit with that secure boot bypass. We see this kind of becoming a thing. So they're saying in this article that it's becoming more common and or attractive to researchers and attackers to kind of go at a focal point. It does help that there are vulnerabilities to exploit for this, but thinking about that, when you talked about kind of like ways to potentially detect or look at this, what are your thoughts on leveraging the, like the TPM logs that to kind of look for, you know, the boot component tampering or, you know, the bootloader, boot manager, UEFI drivers, like to kind of look for unexpected values, changes, tampering. I haven't really looked into this much. It's more just a thought, kind of like throwing stuff at the whiteboard, but it seems like maybe that's a way that could help us as defenders identify if something's happening. Now, like you had mentioned, by the time you're in this place, you're almost all the way down the attack chain, but it might be relevant in an environment to be able to at least isolate a specific measure, especially when I think of Petya because of, you know, the aggressive propagation that Petya, not Petya, used to have. They referencing this as hybrid Petya, so that's one of the things that also pops in my mind. Now, there's no reference of that propagation happening in this current iteration, right. But still, it's, you know, I hear Petya, I'm concerned about the Petya things, right? But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm curious if the TPM logs would be of value here, at least in an environment to help you identify that something had occurred a little faster and be able to, you know, minimize the damage.
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's interesting because there are some systems that will have like good UEFI logs that I've read they exist. I've never seen them, and I'd imagine that I don't know what it's like to remotely collect them, because that would be the biggest benefit. I think the logging for it really was for troubleshooting, right? The system wasn't really for a security-based purpose, because I think people knew that it would be an attack vector, but not something that was going to be broadly attacked, at least from like a ransomware perspective, like where you're trying to hit like a ton of systems, right? I think the biggest challenge though is not so much that people can leverage writing things to the EFI and staging the attack, because the biggest key component here in staging this attack is forcing the reboot. Because if you can't force the reboot, then the attack doesn't really happen. And if someone does know that you rewrote or edited those specific files, remediation can happen before the impact happens, right? Because you can be like, oh crap, we need to go handle this.
Yeah, before that reboot. Yep.
Yeah, fix that. But it uses the same method that Petya did, right? To cause a blue screen of death, which was it invokes the NT Ray's hard error API with the error status parameter set to you know, some hex, but it stands for status host down, and the response option set to value 6, which is option shutdown system, resulting in a system shutdown. So in my opinion, I feel like it'd be really nice if Windows, Microsoft, had a solution to maybe not make that as exposed or leveraged in that way, so that attackers can't systematically make it the system think that it's, you know, crashing and needs to reboot. Because that would then enable all the things we're talking about if they exist to try to get ahead or stop or respond to this effectively. Now granted, I'm sure just like a lot of things, that is a future and that's built in for a reason, and it has its purposes. But you know, obviously I'm assuming you have to have at least a certain level of access to even write to the EFI partition. So you probably have enough access to, interact with that API if it was a permission controlled kind of thing too. So I don't know. I don't really have like the best answer, but I think about the different components that are needed and what potentially can be fixed. And I feel like, unfortunately, a lot kind of lies on what kind of visibility EDRs have and what things they can intercept if they were to see something, because sometimes they could hook things and stop it, right? Or what can Microsoft change as far as access and availability to certain things that are being leveraged that maybe they could control better.
Yeah, and I have to wonder how much you know, typical EDRs or EDRs nowadays are actually considering things like you know, the TPM logs or measured boot stuff or things like that, right?
Yeah, and I do believe that some of them look at least the files. So if there's like a file write to that, they know, or if there was a file write to some of those key things associated with boot, they should, if they have the capability, I think they should be paying attention to that. But yeah, it's just one of those things. I mean, we changed our from BIOS, which is more like firmware based, to now software based with UEFI, right?
Mm-hmm.
We get more capability, but we also have a different surface. Other things to think about.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, so with closing out, I just have one thing to mention that I think people should pay attention to, and that is we do have our threat hunting workshop, Hunting for Persistence. It's a level 2. We have a level 1 out there that's worth checking out. The level point of level 2 is just to kind of add more data, potentially different techniques that, you know, we think require more of a thought process and understanding to kind of take away from. So that will be happening on the 24th of September, and it's a 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's definitely worth checking out, signing up, even if you can't attend exactly at that time, because that will make it easier for you to find the follow-on videos and get access to the lab data and stuff, so you can kind of do this in your own time as well. So definitely check that out. But with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast today. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 15th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.